is Amy Hall. Welcome to another episode of Stand to Reason's hashtag STRask podcast. Greg Kokel's here with me, and we are here. Hello, Greg.
Hey.
We're here to answer the questions that you send us on Twitter with the hashtag STRask, or you can send it through our website. Just go to our contact page. And when you get there, choose I have another question, and then make sure you put hashtag STRask, all one word, into your question. And the question needs to be only just a couple of sentences long. It needs to be the size of a tweet. And if you meet all those requirements, we will consider your question. We love hearing from you. We love to have a lot of questions to choose from. So get on that website. I know you have questions that you've never asked. Now is the day. All right. Yeah. Greg, let's start with a question from Kelly. I recently got into a conversation online with some pro-choice people. They started calling me a rape apologist because I said women who are pregnant through consensual sex should stay pregnant. They said it was body violation, which equals rape. How would you respond?
Well, you know, you just heard me chuckle a little bit there, but it wasn't funny. It was like exasperation chuckle. And the reason is that some things are so ridiculous. It doesn't seem to me to make any sense to respond. Anything that one might say, if I understood this question and issue properly, it seems like anything one might say by way of response could be no more compelling than the prima facie, in other words, on the surface, on the face of it, sensibility of the point to begin with. Okay, because the sexual encounter here was not forced upon the woman, as I understand it from the issue, right? All right.
Mm-hmm.
And then the woman gets pregnant, and the pro-lifer says, you should carry to term. And someone says, that's promoting rape. Is that the way you understood the challenge or the question?
Yeah, they're saying it's a body violation, which equals rape.
Body violation if it's consensual? Is it a body violation if somebody buys dinner for the girl and she decides yes, and then she puts the food in her mouth and eats it? Is that a body violation? That's not force feeding. What am I missing here, Amy?
So the idea is that telling her she has to stay pregnant is a body violation.
All right. Okay, this brings me back to, I'm not sure I can give, here's this clever response, tactically speaking, to answer this, because some of these things annoy me so much that, like I said, they don't deserve a response because, and it isn't that we shouldn't be careful to try to give a response to challenges, but the circumstance itself is so obviously, the challenge is so obviously foolish, no thoughtful response is going to make a difference for a person who offers this kind of rejoinder. It's a body violation because you won't let me have an abortion. All right. Well, okay. Let's just think about this. What is the violation? Nobody's touching the body. The body is doing what the body does naturally, and what appropriately follows from the consensual activity. Nothing is being violated. Everything is happening exactly as it's supposed to happen. The violation is when somebody goes inside of the womb and cuts the child into chunks and evacuates the baby, given one type of abortion. Or maybe floods the uterus with a caustic fluid that chemically burns the baby to death and then evacuates the baby. That's the violation of the body. Birth is natural. Pregnancy isn't a sickness. The body is producing the child. Mom is making a baby. What? I mean, please. This is so insane. So maybe the thing to point out is that the body, when a woman is pregnant, the body is doing exactly what it was made to do, following the consequence of the natural behavior, sexual behavior of the mother and the father. And the baby's being produced exactly normal. There is no violence to the body. The violence is some external action that penetrates and cuts and destroys. That's violence. And that's what abortion does. So how is carrying the baby to term, which is a natural process, violence, and cutting the baby into pieces and sucking it out of the womb, not violence? That maybe that's the question one could ask. And again, I'm sorry. And again, I'm beside myself. It's so ludicrous to make this charge, given, like I said, the prima facie details of the circumstances. Duh, take a look. Duh, I mean, really. I'm not trying to be condescending to people. I'm not trying to say, hey, you're stupid. But let's just be frank. That is a stupid response.
Our culture has decided to pretend that there is no connection between sex and babies. There's just no connection in their mind. They're completely separate things. It's like you brought up eating earlier, Greg. What if I said, well, I consented to eat, but I didn't consent to the calories. Mm-hmm. I didn't consent to that. Why did you force those calories on me?
Right.
No. When you decide to have sex, you are opening yourself up to the possibility that it will create babies the way it's intended to do. It actually has a purpose that it accomplishes. And babies are linked to sex. I think that's what our whole society needs to get back in their heads.
Mm-hmm.
That I think what your distinction, Greg, is great. It's a natural process in what you expect to happen and a body functioning the way it's supposed to function versus a violent interference in that process and a killing of a human being.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's a great approach, Greg.
Thank you. And your observation is a really good one, but that there is an attempt to disconnect sex from procreation, all right? And I think there's a temptation to do that because sex is an act of pleasure and communion and unity, etc. So there are other things that sex can provide for an individual other than building a family, all right? But I think it's much worse than that because I think this is an attempt to disconnect now I'm trying to think of the best babies from mothers. It's an attempt to disconnect babies from mothers. I'm a mother. I'm a woman who is now a mother, and that baby, the circumstance of the baby, is violence towards my body. This is actually an old argument. Eileen McDonough came up with this a number of years ago, and the idea was we can protect our bodies from attacks by other people in self-defense and even use lethal force. The baby is attacking the mother, is the way the argument goes. And therefore, the mother has a right, even if the baby's a bona fide human person, the mother has the right to protect her body from the invasion of this baby, this attack of the baby, you know? And, I mean, this is, I answered this more thoroughly in a piece you can find on the internet on our website called Unstringing the Violinist, because there are two arguments that are similar. One is Judith Jarvis Thompson's violinist argument that came out in 1973. It's been answered by many people, but this was my answer to it. And I include Eileen McDonough here. The characterization in both instances that the baby is attacking the mother. And that is a way of separating the woman, the mother, from her baby. Okay? It's like saying, look at my 3-year-old went into the refrigerator and got a cookie. He's stealing from me. Really? In New York City, and this is in the article, there was a couple that locked their children in their house with food and water and all they needed to survive for a week or 2 weeks, and the couple went to Florida for a vacation because they wanted to get away from the kids. Okay? And of course, they were prosecuted and the children were taken away from them. But why on this logic? Why on this logic? These children were a burden on the parents. They were doing violence to the parents. They were taking away their freedom. How can we force parents to take care of their own children? On this logic. You know, they're violators. They're thieves. They're stealing my stuff and my time, and they are squatters on my property. No, the simple fact is this, and it is self-evident. Pardon me for being intense about this, but this is so bad. Parents have obligations to their own children that they do not have to children that are not their own. Again, pardon me, no duh. All right? And in this particular case, a woman is carrying her own child, which her body is making in virtue of her choices. And that is a natural process. The baby is just where the baby belongs. All right? Just like the 2-year-old or the 3-year-old or the 4-year-old belongs with mom and dad, and they have a moral obligation to care for them and not run off to Florida. It's almost a perfect parallel. The only imperfection is that it seems to me the mother carrying the baby is even more responsible. Because people have ways of getting rid of their kids and taking care of those responsibilities. But there's no way to take care of the baby that's in the womb of a mother.
She's the only one who can do that.
She's the only one that can do that. And to claim that it is violence for her to do to force her to do what her body naturally does, and it is not violence to butcher the baby. And pardon the choice of words, but babies are cut into pieces in the womb. That's what butchers do with bodies. And then evacuated. Anyway.
That's all really helpful, Greg. I think these conversations are really going to heat up in the next few months before the Supreme Court decision. So I would recommend Scott Klusendorf's book, The Case for Life, which goes through a bunch of different objections people can have to the pro-life view. It will help you to explain the pro-life view, to argue for it, to help people to make sense of it. Because these conversations are going to happen on Facebook. They're going to happen over the dinner table. And you need to be ready for that because we don't know what's going to happen when this decision comes down. And no matter what happens, we're still going to need to be persuasive to people.
That's right.
So that because the states will need to decide what they're going to do about abortion. So this isn't going to end abortion.
Mm-hmm.
It just makes it possible for our persuasion to make a difference. So it's time to increase that persuasiveness and our attempts to persuade.
Yeah.
So Greg, here's a question from G.I. Joseph 77. If one struggles with trusting God's control over the circumstances of their life because of emotional doubt, how do they practically turn their distrust into trust?
Well, this is a challenge that I think every single Christian faces. And it's one that I faced. I'm 48 years a Christian. And the reason is that we live in a fallen world that does not function according to God's purposes. God made certain things, made the world a certain way that he called good. It was just the way it's supposed to be in order to accomplish human flourishing the way God made humans. Then there's the fall and everything goes south, human beings included. All right. And so there is this casting out of the garden, and there's a metaphoric sense here that, you know, there was a walking with God and now a casting out of the garden. So there is an alienation from God and a distancing from God. And the distance from God, or the what's the phrase, Amy, that God doesn't reveal himself as aggressively?
Hiddenness.
Yes, thank you. The hiddenness of God is a problem for Christians. And I think hiddenness, this needs to be qualified. God isn't hidden. His evidence, his fingerprints are everywhere. All right. But they're in a personal sense when we are engaging him regarding difficulties in our lives, especially difficulties that seem inconsistent with the way God made the world and ought to be responsive to prayer that is offered to God according to his will. This is a mysterious passage to me. If you pray according to his will, then he answers. Well, wait a minute. I know a lot of things that are according to God's will, the way he made the world, that aren't in my life getting answers, at least haven't for a long, long time. I still persist. You have not because you ask not. Well, that's not going to be said of me about anything important in my life. I'm going to keep pounding, pounding, pounding at the door like Jesus talks about in Luke 11 and other passages. I think it's Luke 11. In any event, there is this hiddenness even from Christians. There is a distance that is greater than we want. We love God. Draw near to God, he will draw near to you. Says that twice, once in James and somewhere else too. Yet, when we work to draw near to God, we don't always have the sense that he has drawn near to us. Now, he's not drawing near in a certain sense metaphysically or ontologically. He's in us. The Holy Spirit is in us. You can't get any closer than that in one sense. So what other sense is there? Well, there's the subjective sense. He will draw near, I will sense his presence more. But that doesn't always work that way. So I'm not entirely sure what to make of that passage. And I will tell you the thing that has helped me the most, and that is going back to Scripture that guides me in the midst of difficult times. One of those is in 1 Peter chapter 2 and 3. I'll make that 2 and 4. And here in 1 Peter chapter 2, Peter is talking about Jesus, who is suffering, committed no sin, no deceit was found in his mouth. Being reviled, he did not revile in return. While suffering, he uttered no threats. And even before that, he said, you've been called with a purpose since Christ suffered for you, leaving you an example for you to follow in his steps. So this is verse 21, 22, and most of 23 that I just read from 1 Peter 2. And then we have the innocence, since the RX for Jesus. And it doesn't say God drew close to him in the midst of those sufferings. It is not what it says. Now, I'm not suggesting God didn't do that in very special ways, but notice the RX that Peter gives us from Jesus. He uttered no threats, but kept entrusting himself to him who judges righteously. Kept entrusting himself to him who judges righteously. So, and then that's at the end of chapter 2, and at the end of chapter 4, there's something very similar. Verse 19, therefore those also who suffer according to the will of God. And we know it is the will of God to suffer. It says so in 1 Peter and many other places. It's implicit, if not explicit. Therefore, those also who suffer according to the will of God shall entrust their souls to a faithful Creator in doing what is right. So we are given an RX during these hard times. And the RX, we would like to have a greater emotional connection to God during those times than sometimes we have. There are times when there is a profound connection and people report this, but it doesn't happen all the time to everybody. But there is an RX for us. Okay, we continue to entrust ourselves to God who judges righteously. He knows. Entrust our souls and do what's right. So there's an RX for us. Okay, so those two passages mean a lot to me. I know them by heart. I know exactly what they are. I have a marker on that page because I go to this passage a lot. And then the Psalms have been a big help to me. And the vast majority of Psalms, if you break them in their categories, are Psalms of lament. David is lamenting before God. Most of those Psalms of lament end in an acknowledgement of God's goodness and that God will eventually come through. They don't all end like that, though. I think there are two or maybe three that don't end like that. I just, a couple of days ago, day before yesterday, read Psalm 74. Now, Psalm 74 is a lament about Jerusalem, about Israel. But there's so many parallels between that in our individual lives. We know why God abandoned Israel or stood back from Israel for a period of time as part of the blessings and cursings, Deuteronomy. David is drawing, we are yours. We belong to you. You redeemed us. Well, these are all true of us as Christians. And so there was a sense in which I could pray Psalm 74 about my own personal circumstances and pour my heart out to God. And the second half, or maybe the last third of whatever, that's the second half, starting in verse 12, there's a different tone. And so what David laments openly and with complete authenticity about the problems that he's facing and pours out his heart before God. Psalm 13 is one of my favorite psalms in that regard. How long, O Lord, will you forget me forever? How long will you hide your face from me? How long shall I take counsel in my soul? I take counsel in my soul, right? So this is us, okay, talking to our souls and telling us our souls the truth, all right? And it's like we feel this is all we have is ourselves. How long will I take counsel in my soul, having sorrow in my heart all the day? How long will my enemy be exalted over me? Consider and answer me, O Lord my God. Enlighten my eyes, or I will sleep the sleep of death. That's Psalm 13. Easy to remember, because 13 is the unlucky number, right? So it's easy to get to. And here's this lament. But after the lament, David says, but I have trusted in your loving kindness. My heart shall rejoice in your salvation. I will sing to the Lord because he has dealt bountifully with me. So there you have that dual aspect, that transparency and that affirmation of who God is. For myself, in the circumstance that G.I. Joseph 77 described, when I'm in that circumstance, this is what I do. 1 Peter, those passages, I have an RX. Entrust myself to him who judges righteously by doing what is right. So that's the combination of those two verses. And then I go back to Psalms. And I know those first five verses of Psalm 13 almost by heart as I pour my heart out using those words in prayer to God. And those are the things that have helped me in those moments when God seems gone.
Mm-hmm. You've touched on so many things I had in mind, Greg. I think I said this many times before, but I think many Christians have not thought about suffering at all. And they've bought into this idea that if you are a good Christian, you will not suffer. So what you have described, Greg, going to the Bible, seeing the Psalms, seeing what happens to the different people who suffered, reading how they responded, that's the first step to regaining your trust, because you need to understand the nature of suffering and who suffers. So there's suffering throughout the entire Bible, of suffering by the people God loved, suffering by those who loved God. It is all throughout the Bible. So the first place to start is to figure out if you had wrong expectations about suffering. Did you think that you would not suffer? And when you start in the Bible and you see what happens there and you see the suffering, that is the first step. But you also need to understand who God is. So I think this is when you're trying to create trust, you need to understand who it is that you're trusting. And the more that you know him, the more you will trust him. So if you're just trying to gain trust, like trying to muster up trust in your heart without figuring out who God is, that isn't going to help you. What you need to do is know God. So again, we're back to the Bible. Read the whole thing. And for this instance, I would suggest reading it fairly quickly so you can see the whole story of how God responded to his people and how he was faithful. You need to understand his character, his faithfulness. And you need to not just read it once, but you need to saturate yourself with it. It needs to become part of the way you think. It needs to shape your mind. The better you understand God and the more you see him work, the more you will trust him. So read the Bible. And next, I would look at lives of Christians who have suffered. There are plenty of Christians who have suffered over the centuries, who've thought about this topic so much, and they remained faithful. I went back and read a bunch of different books by authors who had suffered, and the thing that I found is that they persevered because they loved Christ. And again, you can't love Christ unless you know Christ. So we're right back again to reading the Bible. But seeing how God has been faithful in other Christians who have suffered mm-hmm. is another way to increase your trust. And then you can look back on your own life. See how God has moved you through your life, even in the midst of your suffering. See how he worked in different ways. So that's another way to increase your trust. And finally, my last suggestion would be, there's a book by Gary Habermas called The Thomas Factor. And it's available for free online on his website. So go there, and I recommend the whole book, but even if you just read the part about emotional doubt, the whole section about that, and then there's a chapter on overcoming your emotional doubt. And you touched on this, Greg, in your response, the idea of telling yourself the truth. And it's a very simple process of seeing where you are thinking wrong thoughts about God and replacing them with the truth and just practicing that over and over and over. And of course, in order to do this, you got to start with the Bible, because you have to know what the truth is before you can right. tell it to yourself. Mm-hmm. But it's a very simple little formula he has there for you to start practicing mm-hmm. about telling yourself the truth. And it's very helpful. Mm-hmm. And his whole section on emotional doubt, because we get in all sorts of weird mental loops in our mind that have no relationship to the truth and can make it very hard to trust. So those are the recommendations that I have for this.
You know, Amy, you mentioned about reading the lives of people who are Christians who have suffered a lot. We've recommended over the last few months the book by Rod Dreher, Live Not by Lies, and it's as a cultural assessment. But at the end of the book, it has some stunning material about Christians who were willing to suffer for the truth and how that transformed their lives. So those who purchased the book and haven't read it yet or are interested in this, read it. It's not that long. And especially go to the last portion of the book where they talk about this. And the anecdotes there, you will not believe the stories. I'm mm-hmm. just going to leave it at that. By the way, this idea that if you're really a good Christian or, you know, righteous person, you're not going to suffer is an error that is the subject or topic of the oldest book in the Bible. And the oldest book in the Bible is not the Pentateuch. The oldest book in the Bible is Job. In other words, the one that was probably penned down first. Of course, the Pentateuch goes back in time, recording things that happened before that. But Job deals with this very issue. and the mistake in thinking that if you're really righteous, bad things wouldn't happen to you. I think I just want to close this off by saying, for those in the midst of this, that when you, especially when you read Psalms and you read about other Christians, you realize two things. This is not unusual, what you're going through, and you are not alone. It's not unusual. Nothing wrong with you, necessarily. I mean, sometimes we are suffering because we're goofs, you know, and Peter talks about that, you know. And so, but it's part of the ordinary Christian life. It's not unusual, and you're not alone.
Mm-hmm. In fact, if you can find other people in your church who have suffered, Christians who have suffered are the ones I want to be around the most. They are the deepest. They are the most mature in their faith. They have insights into God's character, and their trust in Him is so much greater. I'm sure there are people in your church who have suffered. You can meet with them. One last book I want to recommend is Randy Alcorn's If God Is Good. That one also has many, many stories of people who have suffered. And that was very impactful for me because I also saw how God worked through all those horrible situations. And it kind of, just the amount of the stories can help you to finally get this deep down from your head into your heart and your soul and to believe it. And of course, it's never easy because suffering is not fun. All right, Greg, I probably shouldn't have taken that question as the last 5 minutes because we've gone way over, but it's such an important topic and everybody will need to think about it. So hopefully we've helped you. And if you have any more questions, please send us those questions on Twitter with the hashtag STRask. This is Amy Hall and Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason.